I'm Daniel.
And I'm Kara Lee.
And welcome to the Actor Hack Podcast.
Coming to you from Brooklyn, New York. Today we have on our show our friend Molly. So where are you from? Where did you go to school?
I'm originally from upstate New York. I went to school for theater in Boston, and then I came here.
Did you know in college specifically what you wanted to do?
I actually started off for costume design, which I loved, but then I missed the people. Designing is so solitary. Mm-hmm. And in ways, I really loved that. But I ended up working on this project with the director, Jonathan Carr, and he wanted me in the room every day as the costume designer. And we kind of created closets for characters rather than creating one look.
Oh, that's cool.
And then they got to decide, like, from the outfits we had chosen, which one they felt their character would wear. And I loved it, but it also made me realize how much I missed the rehearsal room. Mm-hmm. So then I started directing.
So that was you were in school when you realized that?
Yes. I think Boston is a really hard city to become a professional in, because if you're anywhere near that college age, you're just deemed, oh, you're a college student.
Right.
Because colleges make up so much of Boston.
Right.
That you have to. I realized the last time I went back this past summer, I was like, oh, I'm now at the age where people aren't looking at me like, oh, dumb college student that invades our city. Mm-hmm. So right. I'm like, I could come back here. But at this point, I have no interest in it.
What was your plan when you got here?
It so did not happen. I had a few contacts that were working here. I had we'd worked on this project in college that the students from the class had to create a show, and then there were professionals in the field that were like our advisors. Mm-hmm. And our playwriting advisor actually lived in New York City, and I just had always connected with her, and she still lived here when I moved here. Her name is Deb Stein. She now lives in California, unfortunately. But with her, I worked on one of my first New York City productions called Chimera with Under the Radar Festival here Art Center, which was wonderful. And I had also spent one spring break down here with one of my professors working on a show that, like, they just happened to be teching during our spring break. So he was like, come down, see what, like, a New York indie theater tech is like.
Oh, that's cool.
Because that's what you're going to be doing. And really what that gave me more than anything else, it was like, oh, shit, I'm so glad that in my college you had to take lighting design, you had to take sound design, you had to take some beginning acting classes, because, as both of you know, especially doing, like, indie off-off theater, whatever you want to call it, you end up doing kind of everything.
So you sort of felt prepared for that.
As prepared as I could be.
Right, right.
Yeah.
It's very much a, you don't, I'm reading this book I'm producing, actually, from the American Theater Wing right now, and it talks a lot about how you can read books on producing, you can take classes on producing, but it doesn't matter. Like, you're mm-hmm. not going to learn how to produce until you start producing.
That What's the name sense. Of the book?
Producing in the Theater Business, Working in the Theater. Sweet. It's got a lot of different voices, and it's fairly modern. It's 2000s.
Okay, mm-hmm. So cool.
It's not talking about, like, theater in the 80s, which right. is great to learn about. We're in a very different place now.
Right.
So.
What were you going to say, Daniel?
And so you sort of envisioned yourself a director, or...
director.
Okay.
And I figured I've always stage managed mm-hmm. as kind of a way to keep my feet wet and meet a lot of people.
Right.
And knowing that ultimately I'd rather be in a room than not in a room.
Yeah. You know? And everyone's always looking for a stage manager.
It's very, it's very true.
If you're into stage managing, it's a good thing, because when you first get to New York, everybody's like, well, okay, we have everything except somebody to run everything.
Yeah.
Totally.
And I've gotten a fair amount of directing work after stage managing with companies, which mm-hmm. is always nice, because you're afraid you're going to get pigeonholed.
Right, right,
especially
right.
if you're a stage manager and you're a good stage manager. Mm-hmm. It's like, they're just never going to hire me for anything else.
So then the first production that you worked on here, what was your role in that?
It was truly collaborative. Technically, I was the director intern, but there wasn't... They didn't... In the rehearsal room, there wasn't a director. Like, the sound designer had as much to say about directing as the actor on stage.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Which is a lovely way to work with certain people.
And right. I was going to say.
The people that were in that room, I would do it again within a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. Was it a huge production? I feel like that gets more difficult the bigger.
It was only one it was only one cast member.
Okay.
So it was the one cast member, the playwright, two video designers, sound design. The scenic designer was never there because he was out of town, and the costume designer was out of town. So it was a small group, which is part of the reason why it worked.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were things I loved about it, and then there were things that were really frustrating, because it's like, I remember coming home from rehearsal at times and being like, if there was a director, that two-hour conversation would have been a minute.
Right, I can imagine that would be hugely frustrating.
But also, I loved that show. I've worked on it twice. They've toured it. They've had it up at Arts Emerson. They've had it in Colorado. They've had it in Philly. Like, they've been really successful with it on kind of a small-scale terms. And, yeah, I love that show.
Oh, can I, if you don't mind me asking, how were you making money while doing this?
When I first moved down to New York City, I had worked at a Barnes & Noble books, like college bookstore in Boston, and I transferred to a different store down here.
Oh, great.
I didn't stay long in Barnes & Noble, just not for the corporate world in many ways. What was my next production after that? I don't remember.
I was gonna, so when you were getting these jobs, were these all through people that you knew, or did you ever go on sites?
Mostly I go, if I go on a site, I go on Playbill.
Yeah.
And I've gotten a fair amount of work from there. The Oswald stage managing gig was from there. Daughters of Lot, which I worked on multiple times with Brain Melt Consortium, was from Playbill originally.
So it's been sort of a mix of that, and then do you find once you've worked on projects that can sort of lead to another one?
Yeah, at this point, I'm kind of fortunate enough to have, at least for the past 6 or so months, and then it looks like the next 6 or so months, hopefully, all of my gigs have been through word of mouth.
Oh, that's great.
Which is always the best way to get them.
Okay, so you said that you didn't think that you'd be interested in producing, and now you are. So when did that happen?
I started producing, actually, with Brain Melt Consortium. And as I'm sure you two know, you want to do your own work in the city. The best way to do that is to produce it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
So that's how I actually started producing. And then this past winter, I produced for the first time where I was not artistically involved in any way. It was only known as the producer, which was interesting. I originally took it because, like, there was a hole in my schedule. I needed to get paid then. And it was a company that I was really interested in, Poetic Theater Productions. And I'd known a lot of people that worked for them, so I was like, okay, producing. But not being artistically involved, why not? I ended up liking it a lot more than I thought I was going to.
Mm-hmm. And so, for our listeners, will you kind of just break down what you did as a producer?
Well, that was kind of a beast, because it's technically, it's Poetic License, which is a festival. There were two fully produced costume set, everything shows, 6 readings, and 3 one-night events.
Okay. I'm exhausted.
I didn't sleep for like 3 months. It was amazing. There were 4 people on the producing team, but at the same point in time, there were so many, like, 18 to 20 hour days. Looking back at it, I'm like, I don't even know what I did. I emailed a lot of people. I ended up being the person to paint the stage multiple times, too. Because, again, it's just like, okay, well, there's nobody else to do this. Like,
right.
This department has already gone over budget, so I guess I'm painting the stage at 2 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. So basically having to fill in any positions that you can't afford to pay someone.
Yes, yeah. What I find is one of the biggest parts of it is just really trying to listen to what the people in the room need and balance that with what's feasible budget-wise. And as much as the director is often the person with the big picture in mind, like, the producer is the person with the big picture in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, like, looking, okay, in 2 weeks we have to have this ready. Okay, what are we doing on social media today? Because something needs to happen to keep our name out there.
Right.
We have to have new content. So how do we get new photos? How do we get new interviews? Like, how do we not just show them the same picture that we've been showing them for the past 2 weeks?
Right.
Things like that. And it's just, yeah. With a team, it's definitely more helpful. even when producing with two people, there's so much that always, I feel like, slips away because you just don't have time.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you're producing with a smaller team and you're artistically involved. Because there's hours in the rehearsal room. Right. You need to be in the rehearsal room if you're artistically involved. But at the same point in time, it's like you're watching emails floating on your phone. Or you're realizing, oh, shit, I didn't do this.
Are you coordinating press as well? Or is that something
sometimes,
that you delegate?
It depends on who I'm producing with. I like to delegate that to people.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I have a design background and more of an in-the-room background. And I have a background as an accounts manager for, like, companies. I would rather deal with the budget needs, with the designers, what they think they need, mm-hmm. with finding staff,
mm-hmm.
than dealing with press.
Right.
Really, it's an area that I just don't know anything about, so have somebody else deal with this. And yeah, I can deal with other things.
Yeah.
I'll proofread press releases. I'm a great proofreader, but I'm like, I don't want to have to deal with this.
Right. Yeah, but knowing your strengths and weaknesses is part of it, too.
It is. It's a huge part.
So then, when you stopped working at Barnes & Noble, what was the next way that you...
Like, there's been times where I worked at a rehearsal studio for, like, 3 years, and then I freelanced for a while, and then I worked at a different rehearsal studio.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent a lot of time in the last 5 years getting very fed up with my day job and stopping it and freelancing for a while and
mm-hmm.
then getting very fed up with the amount of energy that it takes to keep freelancing up and
yeah.
going back to a day job.
Sure.
Which I think we all do.
Totally.
So.
But was it flexible? Was it a good day job?
It depends on the
first
day job.
Right.
At first the rehearsal studio that I worked at was
mm-hmm.
flexible and was a good job. And then it became not flexible at
uh-huh.
all.
Right.
Which is hard. The day job that I have now is another rehearsal studio, and it's much more flexible again. So you just have to... It's hard because, like, in order to keep it that flexible, you kind of have to keep yourself at a lower rung.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
But then you don't get paid as much.
What's kind of your ideal scenario?
What I would love... I don't know that can happen in New York City just because this isn't the structure of theater in New York City, but ultimately being an artistic director of a company that, like, that's what I do to make money,
yeah,
and that's what I do to, like, fulfill myself, for lack of a better term, would be my ideal.
Have you been directing lately?
In like Divine, which you saw, I
yes.
assistant directed, and then I have a reading coming up in January that I'm directing. And I'm currently working with Tongue in Cheek Theater, same company that did In It Like Divine. I've spent my week reading scripts to find our next project, which I will be directing.
Oh, that's really exciting.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. So then, do you have, like, an official position with Tongue in Cheek?
So I don't have an official position with Tongue in Cheek. I work with them a lot. Jake Lipman is the artistic director. I've worked on the past, well, In It Like Divine... And then we're looking for a full production to do, who knows when, it depends on what the production is and how much money it's going to take. So at this point, we collaborate a lot together. I'm not technically officially in the company.
Mm-hmm.
There was, during the 5 years I've spent here in New York, I've officially been an artistic director, an executive, something for two companies. And
mm-hmm.
as much as I loved it... I don't know that I'm not willing, like, I'm not eager to jump into that situation again.
It's nice now because it's a little bit more casual.
Right.
But you enjoy working with them, so.
Exactly. And not that this has happened with Tongue in Cheek, but with other companies, it's like, okay, but I'm not technically a member of this company, so after this, I get to step away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you all have to deal with your shit.
Right.
Totally.
So,
right. And it sounds like you have a cluster of companies that you enjoy working with, and you have the flexibility to do the projects that you want without the obligation
exactly.
of putting up somebody else's project that you're not necessarily...
And then the thing that I found very difficult about being really... attached to a company is you spend so much time at that producing level that you're not able to take other work.
Yeah.
Like, yes, you might be directing with that company, but I've never found a theater company that every project I want to work on fits in their mission.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So
totally.
Right.
So then it's like, oh, but I don't have time to do this other thing because I'm producing with this company. So I guess I just have to do nothing about that theater that I want to do right now.
Right. I know what I was going to ask you. So you said you were reading scripts in order to consider something to direct. Will you tell me, how does that particular theater company handle that? Do you guys do like an open submission, or what do you do?
So the way Tongue-in-Cheek often works is they try to mix their seasons with revivals that they know will sell well, mm-hmm. and new work. So since In It Like Divine was new work, the next thing that's on the docket will be a revival.
Oh, okay.
And their mission statement is thought-provoking comedies, so then it's just, okay, mm-hmm. a revival of something that's a thought-provoking comedy, and going from there.
And where do you even start?
Both. Jake had things that she was interested in working on, and then I had a couple, so we have swapped scripts, and then we're meeting again.
I got you.
And deciding. There are four that I read. I kind of have already ruled out two completely. just because they're not quite right for me. To direct, really. So then it's just down to those two. And then part of it will... Ultimately, what will most likely be the deciding factor is, okay, this script has X many people, which turns into X dollars, and this
script... Totally.
Mm-hmm. So.
So then, do you guys operate under, like, a showcase code?
Yes, because Jake is most often in the productions as well, and she mm-hmm. is equity.
So will you just explain to our listeners what that means exactly?
I realized recently, I have a really good actor friend that lives in Boston, and showcase code is specific to New York City, which I guess after you live here long enough, you just forget about because you deal with it so much.
Yeah.
Or you try to find all actors that aren't union that you forget that other places in the world, which are a lot of other places, they don't deal with showcase code in the same way. Essentially, because there are so many union actors residing in New York City, the union decided to make a special code that is only pertinent for New York City, knowing that they can get they'd rather have them working.
Gotcha.
Than not working at all. So New York City is actually one of the only cities that has that rung, mm-hmm. because there's different, like, rungs on the ladder of union codes. Mm-hmm. Like, you can have a Lort Theater Code, which is what most of your regional theaters would be working under, and then higher than that. But Showcase Code is only New York City, and essentially it's a way for smaller theater companies to produce something that doesn't have to be all equity, and you're not paying those union actors what you would pay them if you were in a higher union code. So it's essentially not a quote-unquote living wage, although where in New York City pays a living wage for New York City is another topic. but yeah, it's not like living wage. Often the lowest that it can go is travel stipend. So like if you're doing, if your production runs for 2 months, you have to assume that everyone is taking the train, and then it has to be like that much train travel cost.
And so is that, as a producer, you would contact Equity to get that approved?
You have to
go. Is that how that works?
Yeah, you have to submit a form, and mm-hmm. your actors have to sign off on it, and then right. there's a deputy that the director technically doesn't
and then,
know
and
about.
And there's certain rules about how you
There
have
are rules
to
about
yeah.
breaks,
yeah.
Which I was doing a non-union stage manager thing yesterday, and we went from 11:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. with zero breaks. And in my mind, I was like, this is why there are union rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
I sat through half of rehearsal trying to think who I could text that would deliver coffee to the door. to bring me coffee. But yeah, so there's rules about breaks. There's rules about certain hours of rehearsal. There's rules about call times once you get into the show, like once the show opens. There's rules about no rehearsal once the show opens. There are also rules about the way that you can use their name, the way that you can use their marketing, right. their name for marketing, the way that you use pictures. You can't film. It's kind of very strict. There are certain things that I fully understand about it, and then there are certain things that I'm like, especially the no filming part I find hard. Mainly because anytime you go to submit a grant, they want video of something that you've done. The showcase code does not allow you to film anything. Even in rehearsal, you're not supposed to film something. So it's like, okay, well then you're almost directly cutting off a way for me to get money.
Oof. That's the pits.
Yeah. So there's things that I totally get about it, like the break situation. Right. But then there's things, it's like, I'm not going to show this on TV and get paid for it. I just want to use it to submit a grant application.
Do you write a lot of grants?
Not as many as I should. Grant applications get so overwhelming so quickly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And trying to keep up with them and trying to find ones that... A lot of them are very specific.
Right.
So trying to find ones that specific project fits under, it's like, it's a full-time job. It's as many people's full-time job, in fact.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have a certain place that you go to find out what's out there?
A year ago, 2 years ago-ish, I took this wonderful, wonderful workshop with the Drama League about fundraising and how small theater companies or how independent artists can learn things from larger, like, Broadway companies and companies that sustain themselves.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it was, the Drama League has amazing classes and workshops. They're pretty cheap. That one was $30.
Oh,
cool. And the information that I got from it was absolutely worth it.
I gotta make sure. I didn't know that they did classes. That's really cool.
I tend to work with a lot of women on the producing and directing level, so I get a lot of newsletters about grants that are right for women, and that's just the way that I have found is, like, my in, and then I do almost exclusively new work. So then finding what within that new work would make people think it needs to be produced.
Right. Mm-hmm. As far as because you have worked with so many smaller theater companies, can you tell me what you've seen with smaller companies, like what people are doing wrong? Just, I don't know, for people who are just wanting to come here and, like, start a company or, you know, have that, like, what are the major things that you've experienced where it's like, oh.
I was working with this company recently that announced that it was 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And people were amazed because you don't really find indie theater companies that are 10 years old.
Yeah.
It's rare for them to be around for that long and working for that long.
Right.
And I think that a huge reason for that is they outstep where they actually are. It's like, yes, I would love to be in a 99-seat theater and fill that 99-seat theater, but if I'm working in a 30-seat theater and, yes, I'm selling out, I'm not going to sell out in a 99-seat theater. Like, that's a huge jump.
Right, right.
And is it financially better to maybe do a few more shows or, like, to do have a season of 3 shows in a 30-seat theater? So, yes, maybe I have to turn people away than to try and make a jump, rent a theater that's 99 seats, not even get half of an audience for most of those shows.
Yeah.
And then end up losing a significant amount of money. I actually think the biggest thing that small companies do that hurts them is they're project oriented and they're not year oriented or season oriented. They think, okay, for this project I need X amount of dollars, so I need X amount of dollars. Not, okay, for this year maybe I should get X amount of dollars and that will allow me to do all of these things.
Right.
And yes, like, I'm not going to have them at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
All of those dollars at the beginning of the year. But I'll find ways of getting them. Because right. You can absolutely in no way rely on ticket sales.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's also hard to get people to donate, something if you don't have. And I guess that's why it's project-based. It's like, this is what we're doing.
Right.
Your dollar is going directly to this production to pay for this costume, you know.
Right.
Instead of like, oh no, I want to do a season. Give me some money. Like,
right.
Okay, what?
Right, and it is. Well, it is and it's not. Like, if you have investors, if you can show people that you are planning and that this is how you're using your money, their money, and I know smaller companies that have this, they have investors that every year will just give them some money. It doesn't matter what
they've
project
they're
doing.
They have
proven themselves.
How did they get those people?
I don't know. I would love
they're
to.
Angels,
right?
From heaven.
They're angels. But part of it is what Daniel just said. It's they've proven themselves. They can show, like, okay, I've done, I've produced these three productions. I'm not, like, in the hole yet for money. If you give me money, then I can do more productions.
Mm-hmm.
And it just becomes a relationship. And that's mm-hmm. what that class at Drama Week, the biggest thing that she kind of tried to shove down our throats in the best way possible was you need to make a relationship with donors, a relationship with investors. It can't be project-based because project-based yeah. is what's going to be the death of you.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, it's just the question still remains to me, how you meet these donors or you meet these investors.
Well, I guess part of it is keeping, if... knowing the names that have donated to past projects and keeping up a relationship with them, mm-hmm. like actually asking their input on the project mm-hmm. if they got to see it.
Right.
And then saying like, listen, this is what I want to do with my company. Like when I had theater companies in the past, I always sent everybody on our donor list, everyone that we had worked with that year, like, we sent holiday cards with a wrap-up of everything that we had done that year and with what we were going to do the next year. And yes, there was a little, please donate to us and right, remember us right. thing. But it was also a, hey, keep us in mind.
Yeah, I love that.
And I think that that's investing in that relationship and investing in that person so they know that every time that you contact them, you're not asking for money.
Yeah.
I think is... what it comes down to and how it can ultimately be built up that they do donate money every year.
Yeah.
Is because they know, they feel important in your artistic life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they know that every time you contact them, you're not like, can I have more money?
Right.
I think that there are people who have an interest in like this is my favorite theater company. I like them. I go mm-hmm. see all their shows.
Yeah.
What's $25 at the end of the year?
Right.
And I have those theater companies in my heart that I love them. I would give them some money if they asked.
Going back to you personally, as far as before you graduated, knowing that you wanted to be a director,
I got really lucky to be in Boston because there is a huge... It's not as big as New York City, but there is a big indie theater community in Boston as well. And I've been working professionally for my last 2 years of college, either as a designer or as an assistant director with companies, which was a huge...
So you could build your resume,
right?
Then.
I had a resume that wasn't school. All things only done at a university.
Yeah.
Which mm-hmm. is helpful when you get out of school. And then, yeah, I kind of just...
rolled with it?
As stupid as it sounds now, I like, kind of just was like, okay, well, I know like 3 people that live in New York City and work in theater. Mm-hmm. I'm going to move there.
And so did you ever have the thought, like, if New York City doesn't work out, I have contacts, I have network in Boston.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What would you say to someone who's about to graduate and who wants to come here and direct? What would you say to them?
I would definitely say that the actual most important thing that you need to do is find a way that you can financially sustain yourself so you can be in a room and not get paid.
Like, to meet people. And,
right.
And where would you...
You're going to work... Like, yes, you're going to be able to find work that is paying, but... That's not always the room that you really want to be in.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you're young and you first move to New York right. and you sort of have weird tastes and right. you want to do some fun art.
Right.
You're not going to get paid to do that.
Right.
Right.
No, it's absolutely true. And you should. Like, you should absolutely do that fun art and do that experimental art that your friends will support you and come see. And other people will. But... you need to find a way to financially sustain yourself, to be in a room that you're not going to get paid in, because mm-hmm. it always amazes me now when I look at Playbill or when I look at other things, all of the internships that you don't get paid. And some of them, even at this point in my career, like, I would love to do.
Totally.
I can't invest that much amount of time mm-hmm. without getting paid, though.
Right.
Like, you should always... do your homework before getting into an internship.
Mm-hmm.
There are some shady situations out there. Yeah,
and if you're not getting what you want out of an internship, you need to either ask for it or find a new one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's, I guess that's one of the biggest lessons too, is, which I'm still learning, is How do you not burn bridges? The theater world is so small. It's always amazing to me. Mm-hmm. But it's so small. How do you not burn bridges if you don't want to move forward with the project? Or if they ask you to work with them again and you don't want to? Or if you do, for some reason, decide you can't stay on with an internship, whether it's just fulfillment-based or financial stability-based. A huge part of it is not burning those bridges and finding ways to say no and maybe quit jobs, but do it in the best way possible. It's very rare for colleges to focus on the business of being an artist at all.
Which is so preposterous.
It is. But yet, so many, like, most of my friends that are artists, whether they're musicians or whether they're photographers or whether they're cinematographers, they were not taught about the business of being an artist.
Nope.
And yet, you spend so much of your time dealing with contracts. And I've, I mean, so many people have, but I've gotten completely fucked over because I was stupid enough to go into a project without signing a contract. Or I signed a contract with that company once and then didn't sign a second one the second time I worked with them and was like, oh, I've worked with them once. And then I got fucked over. Why does...
Right. It's like, you should know. I mean, that should be something for every artist in any sort of capacity. They shouldn't leave college without at least having like a basic knowledge of how to read contracts. You know, because it's not like you're going to be able to hire an attorney to read this, like,
no,
contract
can't.
For you.
That's, yeah, you can't hire an attorney. And if you want to direct or produce, then you need at least a base level of contracts to write them.
I think my thing with, like, directors and stuff, I was always so confused as to, like, if you didn't go to, like, grad school at Yale or one of these sort of, like, mafia schools that kind of sort of come to New York and take over. I'm just kind of like, what, how do you get a job as a director? Like, it's really abstract to me.
It's really interesting. I was reading this fascinating article, which if you don't know about HowlRound, HowlRound, you should definitely check it out. They have amazing articles put out there by artists from all over the country on producing all women's work, on directing, on playwriting, all over the board.
That's cool.
About that. They had an amazing article about how the system that we've built in the theater right now kind of makes directors have to latch onto a playwright and hope, like, hell that that playwright is loyal to them.
God, that's so true.
And that playwright doesn't get an offer and just drop that director. Because that happens all the time. But it is kind of how you have to prove yourself as a director, is just hope that the playwright that you chose, goes somewhere, and then hope that the relationship that you have with that playwright is strong enough, and that they believe in your work enough to keep you on.
Right.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Right. And a playwright has a vested interest in working with a director that gets them.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean...
But also, when you get the offer that's the next step up, you're like, oh, yeah, I want to work with that director.
Yeah, like, well, totally. Right. Yeah.
Or like, yes, well, we want to put on a season of your work, but we have our in-house directors.
Exactly.
Right, what are you going to do?
And then the director that's developed your work is like, okay.
Right.
All right, okay, all right. So,
So it is really hard because... There are very few cases, like, even when you look at Playbill or when you look at job sites, it's very rarely for a director.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because
assistant
that's
directors,
thinking,
yes. Playwrights, yes. Stage managers, yes. Designers, yes. The director? No. Which is why you end up being a producer.
Right. Right. Do you... Because I know you've done a handful of assistant director gigs. Do you ever find that those develop into being asked back to direct, or...?
They have a few times. I don't know. I've found that it's getting harder and harder for me to be in the room if that room doesn't really want my voice. Like, if what they're expecting, and what a lot of people expect from an assistant director, is for them to shut the hell up and take the director's notes.
Right.
That's what, I mean, that's what I was going to ask, because I feel like in different arenas, that assistant director means a different thing.
Right.
So, what, I mean, how would you define, I mean, if there's much else besides what you just said, what an assistant director at, like, an indie theater level, what they do?
I have worked with the directors that it's shut the hell up and take my notes. And then I've worked with the directors that's like, okay, we're focusing on these things in rehearsal. Can you specifically watch for these things? Like, watch to make sure they're pantomiming correctly, or that they are putting down the props where I said, or that, you know, their accent doesn't break, so I can focus on other things.
Right.
And I've also worked with directors that are like, okay, I'm working on this scene. Can you go in a little, like, corner and run lines with these two actors? And that's the room I'd rather be in as an assistant director, because it's obviously more fulfilling. You feel like, you know, your brain is being used.
Yeah.
And you feel like you're doing something for being in that room.
Cool. Well, so we like to do this thing at the end of our show.
Okay.
Each have our own hack. So even though you've said many glorious things and given a lot of advice, I'm going to ask you to give us some more.
I would like to go back for my hack this week. I'd like to go back to what you said about burning bridges, because that's actually something that we haven't talked about before, and that's actually, it's a huge part of everyone's life when they first move to the city. You're trying things out, you don't know what kind of day job's going to work for you, you don't know what kind of internship is going to work for you, and so you have to dabble a little bit, but it's going to come back to you if you don't treat it with some finesse.
Totally, yeah. And I mean, especially at this level, just to bounce off of that, like, you know, I'm a talent manager now, but I'm also still in the independent theater world. I have been for years, and I will never forget someone who screwed me over.
So it's so true, though.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's not an everyday situation that comes up, but, you know, if I'm approached by someone, you know, wanting representation, and I remember you flaked out of a show 4 years ago, I'm like, nope.
People ask around and people talk.
Oh,
like,
totally.
Have you heard about Daniel? It's like, don't work with that guy. He's terrible. You know? It's,
totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll, like, see who your mutual friends are on Facebook and immediately be like, should I work with that person?
Right!
You know? So that's, yeah, I think that's really important.
And I've worked with actors before that had to step away from a project for whatever reason and did it in a beautiful way, in a way that I have hired them again.
Yeah. Right.
And I've worked with actors that stepped away from a project and I was like, I will tell everyone not to work with you.
Totally. I will have a great time telling people not to work with you. Yeah.
And people understand, especially if it's an internship and you're broke and, you know, it's like, you can't blame this 21-year-old who just graduated from college who stepped into a situation that they can't handle.
Totally.
Yeah.
But it's all about handling it correctly.
Yeah.
So I love that. Okay, so my hack for this week. There's the HBO documentary Casting By. Have you seen this?
I haven't heard about it.
Yeah, so it talks about sort of like the first casting director in New York and how that became a profession. And then it moves in to talk to a lot of the ones that are still working today. For anyone wanting to know a little bit more about that and just even, I don't know, just that side of the table. I don't know. I think it's always good to know about every single aspect. So that would be my recommendation. Casting By.
So I think my hack is, or my advice is, to find a way, even when you're working on those projects that you're not exactly thrilled to be in the room, or you're working, or you're purely working to make money and you don't have the time to work on artistic things at the moment, find a way to do something that fills that niche for you. Because if you don't, you get really bitter about things really quickly.
Totally.
And you get, like, the worst part is you get bitter towards your friends that are working. I mean, I think we've all done it, even if it's for a short period of time.
Totally.
Like, God damn it, why are you working and I'm not working? So I think that's my biggest, one of my biggest takeaways from in the past 5 years, is finding a way that even when I'm not working, or when I'm working on something that I'm not thrilled about and I'm not promoting in the same way I work on other things, is finding a way that I feel fulfilled enough that I'm not mad at everyone else in my life for actually doing things they like doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really great tip.
Yeah. I've definitely been in that situation where I'm, like, fuming, and it's like, when's the last time I worked on something that I enjoy?
Right.
Oh, that was a couple months ago. I need to get working on something.
Well, that's so great. Well, Molly, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you for asking me.
A lot of fun. Great. So, thank you all for listening, and please subscribe to us, follow us on Instagram, like us on Facebook, email us at actorhackpodcast@gmail.com if you have any suggestions or questions. We'd be happy to answer them.
If anything, my mother will listen to it.
You've been listening to All That Glitters by Sweet Soubrette from the album Days and Nights.